Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and I'll be talking today to the two authors of Initiatives Without Engagement, A Realistic Appraisal of Direct Democracy's Secondary Effects. The book is published by University of Michigan Press, and the two authors are Josh Dick, who's here on the phone. Josh, are you there?
I am here. Yes. Hi, Heath.
Great. And also Ted Lasher. Ted, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks,
Heath. Good. Yeah, it's great to have you both with us. What I'd like is for each of you to introduce yourself very briefly or in whatever way you would like. And so, Josh, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Josh Dick. I'm an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and I also am the co-director of the UMass Lowell Center for Public Opinion.
Great. Ted, and how about yourself?
I'm Ted Lasher, and I'm a professor of public policy and administration at Sacramento State. Just heading back to the faculty after having served as interim dean of social sciences.
Oh, well, so you must be very tired and looking forward to your move back into the classroom. It's such a pleasure to have you both on and to have read your book. Josh, maybe I can start with you. Your book is focused on ballot initiatives. And for the uninformed, and I think most of us probably aren't that informed on how these what the history of ballot initiatives are. Maybe you could talk a little bit about their political development as a tool of democracy and when we see them first introduced and what the primary purpose was.
Sure. Ballot initiatives in the United States context, at least, were something that really sprouted out of the populace and then the progressive movements at the turn of the century. So we see them start to show up in the early 1900s as a reform package in states. And they were largely seen as sort of a part of a larger menu of reforms that were meant to sort of sap the power of political parties within states. So we see them as part of this larger sort of progressive movement reform. And early on, they were used quite a bit in the states that adopted them. I mean, most of the states, we ended up getting them in 24 states. You see ballot initiatives adopted where people can actually write laws that are in complete circumvention of the legislature. So you can actually, pass a law that the legislature never touches. Get a petition, get it through, have it approved, and get it to a popular vote where you're actually voting in sort of a referendum style at the end, where, 50% plus one, or in some cases a higher threshold, gets it to to become an actual law. And so that's kind of the setup. For a while, they were used quite a bit when they were first passed, and then we kind of went through this period where they were used a little bit less in the sort of 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then around the 1970s, we saw this tax reform movement start with Proposition 13 in California, and we saw the sort of explosion of things around taxes, and then we've seen a bunch of issues in recent years show up via ballot initiative. And so it always seems that sort of the most controversial policies that are being pushed through in the states often get kind of this litmus test through the ballot initiative process. That's often where we see things like same-sex marriage and a variety of things that have to do with institutional reform. Maine has recently done ranked choice of voting through the ballot initiative. So that's kind of a sort of the briefest history of initiatives that I can give.
Yeah, and Ted, the book is mainly about what you call the spillover or secondary effects of initiatives. What are the types of effects that you're referring to exactly, and why might we expect these kinds of secondary effects? And you know, what is the literature thus far surmised about whether these have been primarily positive or negative?
Josh explained that this the initiative process basically came out of particularly the progressive movement. And almost from the beginning, claims were made that by participating in initiatives, ordinary citizens would essentially become better citizens, that this process would make them more interested in politics, it would make them feel more powerful, or in political science terms that's often used, more efficacious. It would make them more convinced that public officials were reacting to what they wanted. It would perhaps make them more knowledgeable and trusting. So these sorts of, it wasn't, as we found, it wasn't necessarily a very coherent philosophy there, but these claims were made almost from the beginning. And then they were picked up probably in the sort of late 1990s and early 2000s by political scientists who tried to test some of these. And some of the early literature claimed that they actually found some of these effects. The other thing I should have mentioned, of course, was turnout, that more people would be more inclined to vote if there were initiatives on the ballot. And so there was some early literature that claimed this. We and some others were skeptical, that we doubted that initiatives had this effect because we didn't see the political psychology working the way people often claimed. Josh and I, and a few others separately and in some cases with us, looked at some of these effects, and they didn't hold up well for the most part.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the data that you came to, and then we'll talk about sort of what you found. What are the right data to connect the initiative process to secondary effects? Where did you look? And then we'll talk about the actual analysis.
Yeah, sure. So it's a difficult process to try to connect data on the initiative process to this idea of secondary effects and study, you know, effects on individuals at the state level. And so I think the earliest studies of this, and this is something in literature even prior to the book Ted and I kind of focused on, were looking at data from the American National Election Study. And so until very recently, ANES was done using sort of this pooled cluster sample methodology, which is the idea that because they use face-to-face methodology, they can't do like a perfectly random sample like you would in a telephone survey. And so they subsample out metropolitan areas, and then they survey a bunch of people in those metropolitan areas. And so it's been known for a long time that if you're trying to study congressional districts or states' effects in those areas, that you're not going to get good subsamples with the NES. And so a lot of the studies that were used early on to study the effects of the ballot initiative on these outcomes weren't really well suited. And so for us, we were trying to look to newer, kind of much larger data sets that would give us accurate sub-state samples. And so the bulk of the book uses the Cooperative Congressional Election Survey, and also survey data from Annenberg from 2004 and 2008. But the CCES in particular provided us with an ability to test turnout effects in a way that we hadn't been able to before, because they have these large surveys with vote validated data. And also they have, we had an ability to study these sub-state effects in ways that we really weren't able to do with some of the previous data.
There's one thing I would add on this, and maybe it's because it seems so obvious to Josh and me that we may forget to mention it, that one advantage you have in studying initiatives is that not only do some states have the initiative and some states don't, but some states use the initiative a lot more. So like California and Oregon, and then some states use it a lot less, like Missouri. And so you can take advantage of the variation in initiative use to do analysis.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and Ted, one of the interesting findings that come from the data relate to voter turnout, something you just mentioned earlier. What does your analysis say about the relationship of initiatives to changes in voter turnout?
Well, our initiative generally supports the argument that, although with qualifications and in certain circumstances, that the initiative process does tend to provide some increase in voter turnout. The critical thing, though, is that we don't see it related to people being more civically engaged. So some of the literature before claimed that it was increases in engagement and interest that were producing the rise in turnout. Whereas we find, for example, that with respect to interest, there's really no difference across initiative states and non-initiative states. There is this increase in turnout, but we attribute it differently. We think it has much more to do with mobilization and the fact that particularly in sort of divisive initiative campaigns, sort of marginal voters are brought to the polls. And Josh did the most work on this, so he's probably best at going into the details here.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, Ted actually did a great job summarizing the findings with Aptor on turnout. I would emphasize that, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, we did a bunch of work here with the data, but essentially we were trying to make this larger theoretic point. I mean, one of the things that you find in this turnout chapter is that our findings, or at least the basic findings, which is that ballot initiatives increase turnout, mirror a lot of what it already says in the literature. The essential puzzle of the book, right, is that this finding exists, that ballot initiatives increase turnout, and that finding has been replicated over and over and over again. But there were all these previous studies prior to us writing this book that shows that ballot initiatives increase turnout without having these other things that were supposed to be increased before turnout going up. And so the point of this chapter five is for us to kind of try to unravel this turnout mystery, right? Which is, why does turnout go up without us seeing increases in things like voter efficacy and political knowledge And the part of that democratic citizenship bundle that was supposed to sort of educate voters and lead to their increases. And so what we do in sort of leading up to that is build an alternative theory, which is that it's a conflict process, right? So there's an increase in conflict that's going on here. Ballot initiative campaigns are making people angry at each other, and that's what's leading to mobilization. But it's these conflictual campaigns over same-sex marriage, and it's the process by which wealthy extremist entrepreneurs put initiatives on the ballot, and that is what spurs turnout in these one-off campaigns. And so, yes, we find the turnout effect, but we find it without relevant increases in political interest or in voter registration, and we find that the effects are isolated mostly to partisans and not to independent voters. And so that kind of gives you kind of the basis for why we find this robust turnout effect that we find and that 10 others before us have found, without seeing all those other things that were supposed to happen before.
Now,
the
Ted, what motivated progressives to advocate for initiatives was a concern about partisanship and political parties. Based on what Josh has just said, their work may have been in vain on the polarization front. What did you guys find on the issue of partisan sorting and polarization? You've just told us about voter turnout and interest, but what about our concerns about polarization? Does it rise or fall with that?
Well, in general, what we find is that if anything, greater use of the initiatives is associated with more polarization, and particular and more sorting, and that is the distinction being sorting is more sort of ideologues of one stripe falling into a particular party, and ideologues of the other stripe falling into the other party, and polarization is greater distance between them on issues. And if anything, the initiative process is associated with more polarization.
And Josh, how could this be? One of the things we haven't talked about that you both have alluded to is the mobilization and entrepreneurship that goes on around ballot initiatives. This isn't what progressives imagined, but it is what most people today think about when we think about initiatives. That is the advertising campaigns, the ways in which media is involved in promoting initiatives on hot button issues. So how do those things come together? How do entrepreneurs relate to these findings that you've discovered on sorting and polarization? Is this essentially a partisan phenomena at this point?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the reality is that there aren't little R's and D's next to the outputs, the yes and the no's on ballot initiatives, but almost all ballot initiative voting is constrained by party ID, and people find the relevant partisan sides of these ballot initiative campaigns. And so because most of this is partisan voting, and we've known that for a number of years, what this has become and what primarily our argument when you get into chapter 6 in this book is that the ballot initiative then becomes a way to expand the partisan battleground and to actually to make it more issue-based. So you can use controversial issues to expand the way in which you let people know that the parties are different from one another. You know, by putting... By forcing people to vote on a initiative about whether we should define abortion as personhood, as they had to do in 3 times in 8 years in Colorado, okay, that's going to increase partisan sorting, because people in Colorado, if they didn't know before where they were. If there was any ambivalence about where you were on the abortion issue, you are put in the position, if you're a voter, of making sure that you actually figure out what your position is. And so this puts people in that position of having to force themselves to apply their partisanship to those issue positions in a way that they may not have fully done. And so it completes that sort of cycle and forces the issue of partisanship. Yeah.
So and to be clear, so this happens. So in some sense, the process tells partisans how they should be on issues, but it is not associated with any increase in general political knowledge. You know, we also looked at that question, and you know, if you look across initiative and non-initiative states or varying in terms of initiative use, you don't find any greater general political knowledge in among places where people face more initiatives.
Now, Ted, you end the book with some recommendations, and you divide those recommendations up into a couple of different categories. What do you recommend to scholars interested in studying direct democracy and initiatives?
Well, one thing we recommend is that people sort of give up on the idea that the progressive era had a coherent philosophy that sort of hung together well and fit with, you know, sort of larger philosophical strains. And that really wasn't the case. And that we keep trying to imagine that it provides a template for thinking about the initiative process. And we don't think it does. There were ideas coming out of the progressive era, but they weren't as coherent as people often think. And we're paying a price for thinking that they were onto something with respect to how direct democracy affects civic engagement.
And Josh, what about for the wider world of policymaking and advocacy? What do you recommend to them? Are you a part of the abolish the initiative process camp, or are you going to take a sort of a different, more nuanced approach to the subject?
You know, I think that it's actually more complicated than that, because if you were to, you know, I think any abolition of the initiative would come with the notion that you would need to do that by initiative. And I don't think that you could abolish the initiative by initiative in states that did it, or you'd have to have a constitutional convention. And so, you know, I think that, and constraining the initiative process further means that you're going to close the door so only maybe the wealthiest elites are able to use the process in certain states. I do think that states that use the indirect process and have fewer initiatives are potentially able to get some of the benefits, the reform benefits of the initiative process out of it without as many of the potentially negative effects of the process. But I do think that you really, it's difficult to imagine the catch-22 that this process puts people in, which is that they generally like the idea of public voting, but then when you start to ask them a lot of the questions about, you know, what are the negatives of this process, that they think that the questions are very complicated. They find that the process has been co-opted by elites, and they don't like how much money has been spent. And so I think that, you know, if you were going to look at what should be done with the initiative process, I don't think you want to abolish the initiative. I think you want to focus on ways that the public would support reforming the process to constrain its usage, to kind of deal with its worst impulses.
Yeah, again, the book is Initiatives Without Engagement, A Realistic Appraisal of Direct Democracy's Secondary Effects. Josh and Ted, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Heath. This was fun.